ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the UI Breakfast Podcast. I'm your host, Jane Portman, and today our guest is Matt Englert, founder of Freelance Transformation and micro-agency owner, and we're going to talk about qualifying consulting clients today.
This episode is brought to you by your productized consulting guide. Want to get started with productized consulting? This book will teach you step-by-step how to craft your offer, overcome client objections, write your sales page, and strategically plan your services line. To get your copy, head over to uibreakfast.com/productized and use your special promo code PODCAST20 on checkout to get 20% off any book package.
Hi, Matt.
Hey, Jane, how are you?
I am doing great, and I hope you're doing great, too.
I'm doing awesome and excited to be on your show.
We're thrilled to have you. Well, let's start with the Bliss questionnaire, which is 5 questions about yourself, and then continue to the main topic. How does that sound?
That's exciting.
Question number 1 is, surprisingly, what do you do for a living?
So I am first and foremost really an agency owner. I have my own micro agency, as you mentioned. We do website development and largely now specifically for membership sites. And I've done that for the last 12 years. And out of that sprang Freelance Transformation, which was really my desire to connect with other consultants and freelancers out there and build up a network and ultimately help other people figure out how to do consulting the right way. So I've been doing that for 2.5 years. There's the Freelance Transformation podcast, and of course, the mailing list on Freelance Transformation. And we're just trying to figure out how to make consulting and freelancing better.
Fantastic. How did you get there? What's your background story?
So I got into originally freelancing. it's 12 years ago, I got into freelancing because I was working at a startup, and it was kind of a dream job. It was paying the bills, allowing me to get through school at the same time. But unfortunately, as startups tend to do, this one ran out of money. So suddenly I realized I have nothing to live off of, and I need to do something about that. So I started building websites for people because that's something I knew how to do, and I could do it around my schedule. And the first website I sold was for $300. And then from there, very quickly, I sold another one for $700, then $1,000. And right up until about $3,000 a website, it was pretty easy. And then I kind of hit an interesting point where for a long time, I couldn't get past that. But I'm sure we'll talk about that. But yeah, my story of getting started was just when I realized that, you know, I was laid off.
What does your typical day look like?
Depends on the day. So Tuesdays and Thursdays are usually my meeting days, and those are just jam-packed of meetings. If anyone wants to connect with me for any reason, 90% of the time we're going to do that on a Tuesday and Thursday. Ironically, this call is accepted. But usually Tuesdays and Thursdays are meeting days. And the reason I do that is so that Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays, I can mostly focus on doing work on my agency or on Freelance Transformation with very few interruptions. So I get up pretty early, usually around 6, 6:30, but I always do make sure to get 8 hours of sleep. And I try to do most of my most important work in the morning so that by the time the afternoon rolls around, I feel like I've already accomplished what I need to accomplish, and then I can take care of the other details and administrative work and so on. And that's a pretty good schedule for me. How long I work really depends on the day. The nice thing about working for yourself and setting up your business in a certain way is that you don't have to work 8 hours a day. That's not the metric of success anymore. But I also enjoy my business. I enjoy my work. So sometimes I'll work till 5, sometimes I'll work till 2. It depends.
What exactly do you do for your agency? Is it purely managerial work or some hands-on work as well?
Great question. So right now, my main roles are sales, some aspects of project management, and most importantly, figuring out the strategy for clients. So when a client first comes to us and approaches us about getting some sort of web project built, that's where I have the opportunity to really dive in, first of all, and figure out what it is about their business that they're trying to solve, what business issue this project is going to solve for them, and then figure out what kind of approach we can take that is going to deliver real, actual value for them. And so it's a strategy part that I really love, and that's where I'm most involved hands-on. I do, surprisingly, also do some programming in PHP. We have a whole big framework that we've created, and I do love to get my hands dirty in that whenever I have a chance, and continue adding features and things like that.
So just we have context, because we're going to talk about your own experience as well. How large is your micro agency?
So as the name implies, it's not very large. So when I first started my business, I was a freelancer, and I was doing basically almost everything myself. And then I got it into my head that the only way to run a business was to run a big business. So I started renting office space. I hired my first full-time developer. Then I hired a second full-time developer. Then I got a bigger office space and started hiring more people. And eventually, at the beginning of 2011, I realized I was utterly miserable. I did not like the business that I had created for myself. I was working 80 hours a week. I had to commute to work. I didn't enjoy being in an office all day, even though we had like 11 different colors of paint on the walls. I still just didn't enjoy the office environment. So at the start of 2011, I basically blew it all up. And I said to myself, well, what is it about this business that is actually working? And what about it isn't working? And there was a number of financial issues. And then there was also issues around my own happiness with it. So then I rebuilt the business. I rebuilt it as virtual. I rebuilt it mostly with contractors. So we don't have much payroll at all. Almost the entire team is contractors. And instead of focusing on trying to build a big team and build a big agency, I focused on building something that's highly profitable and also something that's highly flexible. So now we're talking, I have a team of basically five, and all of them are part-time, mostly contractors. So there isn't a single full-time employee anymore. And I can scale up and scale down depending on the type of work that we have coming in and what actually needs to be accomplished, instead of, for example, trying to invent four full-time weeks of work for a developer every month because I have a full-time developer, which wasn't working very well.
It's a pretty scary thing to have such qualified workers on a payroll, right?
It is terrifying. I mean, the expenses around that traditional model are just phenomenal. So you have the expensive office space. You have all the stuff that comes with it, like water delivery, coffee delivery, insurance, all the things that you don't even think about. And then you have the people that are actually working in that office space, which are way more expensive than the rent itself. And there's a particular type of pressure that comes with knowing that every 2 weeks, you have to make sure that these people get paid. Their livelihood depends on it. And if you mess up, if you have a bad couple months, something happens, and you can't pay them, you're in real trouble. So it just got emotionally exhausting, even during good times, because I always felt like I was on this treadmill where if I wasn't constantly bringing in work and we weren't constantly pumping out work, as soon as I just took a breath, the whole thing would just collapse around me.
Yeah, you're definitely not alone sharing such memories from your past. Remember Brandon Dunn and everybody else also sharing their agency experience, very similar. What do you enjoy the most and the least about your work?
I think what I enjoy most about my work is the fact that I can genuinely help my clients see their business in a different light. And that's going to touch on the topic that we're going to get into about identifying your ideal clients. But over time, I've built up a roster of clients where I've truly been able to make an impact on their business. It's not just about creating a website. I mean, websites are nice, but it's about being able to help them see their business in a way that is completely different, in a way that helps them open up new ways of selling their product, new approaches to their pricing, new ways of keeping their members, whatever it might be, and utilizing the web in a way to do that. So that's incredibly rewarding because then you look back on clients that have been with you for 2, 3, 5 years, and you see the changes in their business, and you can be like, well, I was actually a part of that. There's a real impact that I had on their revenues, on their happiness, on the way that their business runs. So for me, that is absolutely my favorite part. Probably second favorite is just the sheer flexibility that I have in my schedule. Least favorite is probably when things are going wrong on a project. Over time, we've developed really good processes to minimize that. For example, every client now absolutely loves the end result, and that's not an accident. That's a lot of work on processes and the way we approach everything. But inevitably, there's challenges on a project, oftentimes timeline challenges. And when you're feeling that crunch, when you know you got to pull through, you got to figure out what's happening on a project, that's the part that's my least favorite. If I woke up tomorrow and never had to deal with that again, I'd be happy.
All right. What is your next big thing?
My next big thing. Oh, my. All right. Well, I think my next big thing right now is refocusing my agency. So like I mentioned at the beginning of the show, we've been going more and more towards just highly custom membership sites. That's a niche that we discovered after taking on a number of those clients over a number of years and realizing that that's the type of business that we can really have a hugely significant impact on. So I'm experimenting with the idea of just going all in on that to the exclusion of everything else. And that's probably where most of my attention is focused. And then the other next big thing is continuing to build up freelance transformation. I have a course that I created and launched last year. It was an exhausting but hugely rewarding experience. And I intend to continue to grow that and to grow the client or student base behind that.
We'll link to the course in the show notes if it's still available. Is it?
Yeah, absolutely. We can put up a link. You might see a waiting list page there depending on when you visit because the course is open periodically throughout the year and not all the time. But we can absolutely link to it. And if it's not open, you can join the wait list.
Awesome. What is it about?
It's about helping you build a freelance or consulting business in the right way. And specifically,
surprise,
how to get... Yeah, exactly. Surprise. The stuff I talk about all day.
Sorry.
And specifically about how to get clients and how to build up a client base and how to build up the right client base and how to do it step by step. I spent a lot of time just breaking everything down into small manageable steps that you can do every week and trying to remove as many of the barriers as possible that keep people from actually finishing and doing the work.
Wonderful. So I'm thrilled to have you here today because you've been teaching other freelancers through your guests, through your wonderful materials for years. Today you'll get to dispense your wisdom here at my podcast, which I'm thrilled about. So we talked about having dream clients, and it seems that the process consists of two parts. One is defining who the ideal client is, who your audience is, and the second is actually identifying whether actual human beings who come in the door belong to that audience. So why don't we start with part one, finding your niche and defining who is your ideal client?
Absolutely. So you're probably asking, how do I define my ideal client?
Right. I like to that look. That is a very wide question.
Yeah. Well, we can go into a few things. So when I look at how to define your ideal client, what I encourage my students to do and what has worked really well for me is to basically look at three different things, particularly when you're trying to first figure out who you should be targeting. So maybe you're just starting out. Maybe you target everybody right now. How do you narrow that down? Number one is figuring out what type of client is actually going to be profitable for you, and you're going to be profitable for them. That's hugely important. So that's the financial math, probably the most important, and it has to work both ways. So we can definitely get into that. And then the second thing is the qualitative factors. So, for example, in my course, I actually have my students define a freelance manifesto. So have them explain why they're freelancing. And what we do then is we turn that into real qualitative criteria about that client that they have to meet to be an ideal client. So for me, one of the big things is that I work remotely. I have met with a lot of clients in person over the years, and I still don't mind doing it once in a while. But bottom line is I like working from home, and I don't want to spend 2 hours a day just driving back and forth between different places. So any clients I take on, they have to be willing to work remote. I also don't take on clients whose needs involve getting work turned around very quickly. And by quickly, I mean in a matter of days. So if someone emails you on Monday and you need something ready for them by Wednesday, that's not the type of client I want to pursue. So there's different criteria, and what criteria you establish there depends entirely on you. And then the third thing that we can look at is what kind of clients actually fit within your sphere of influence, because I like the idea of not making life more difficult for yourself than you have to. And one of the best ways to make sure you're not making life difficult is to target the types of clients that you're most connected to in different ways. And there's different ways to evaluate that. But bottom line is, if you're trying to target CEOs of Fortune 500 companies and you don't know that world at all, that's going to be much more difficult than targeting a different type of client where you actually have ins and connections to and so on.
Is there a chance? Of course, it's easier to define somewhat good idea of your audience if you already have been freelancing for a while. But if you're just starting out, what are the shortcuts to finding out who's the best to work with?
So it definitely helps if you've already freelanced a little bit, for sure. And what that allows you to do is start looking at what clients you've freelanced for before that you liked versus ones that you didn't. But sometimes that still doesn't give you the right data anyway, because a lot of the times when we're starting out, we're not working for our ideal clients. So looking at that data, that might be kind of misleading. So instead, one of the things that you can really do for yourself is start understanding why clients hire us in the first place. And clients hire us because they have a business problem that they're trying to solve. And they're hoping that by hiring you, you're going to be able to solve that problem for them. So let's take my agency as an example. We build websites. Okay, fine. A lot of people build websites. And a lot of people need websites. But there is an entire world of different reasons that people want to get a website built. So let's say a client comes to us and says that they want to build a website. The first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to dive in and find out why they want to build that website. And hopefully we're going to find out something like they want to build a new website because they get a lot of their leads online. And they're hoping a better website is going to allow them to get more leads, basically let them convert more visitors into actual people contacting them. So that has the potential to be a good client. So if we realize that that's really what the client is trying to solve, then we can start putting some numbers on it. If this is a bigger company, what is a lead worth to them? Well, it could be worth a lot. For example, typical service-based business, like renovation or home builders, plumbers, HVAC, that kind of thing. Those are the kind of typical businesses that get leads, or business to business, software solutions. They also need leads. Those leads are worth thousands of dollars to them, because when a customer buys a product for them, they're spending thousands or tens of thousands of dollars with them. So it's really important to get that person to actually get in touch with that company and not just leave the website. And if it's a bigger business, then there's a chance that they have a lot of traffic coming to the site already. They have a lot of marketing happening. And that means that when we can take this website and we can build a better one that's going to take more of those visitors and turn them into leads, get more people contacting them, then that company probably stands to make a lot of money by us doing that. So if that is why they're trying to build a website, then they're probably going to be willing to pay us pretty well if we can actually accomplish that result for them. On the other hand, let's say that you get approached to build a website by, say, your local church, and they want a website because they want to be able to post events that are coming up at the church and post some contact information and things like that. Well, the problem that they're trying to solve is basically how can they communicate with their congregation? And let's start putting some dollar values on that. What is that really worth to them? I don't know, but it's probably not worth a lot. They're not going to be willing to spend tons and tons of money to improve how well they can reach their congregation, because they're not going to make a lot of money from that. And they're not even really interested in making money. So both of these different examples are organizations that want a website, but their motivations for wanting that website are very different. And also their potential returns on their investments are very different. That big company that needs more leads might be looking at tens or hundreds of thousands of dollars in new business as a result of a better website. The church might be looking at a slightly happier congregation, and that's about it. So knowing this, sorry, you want to interject here?
It's a pity that the church has come up again in our podcast as an example of a not a great client, because we had an episode with Patrick McKenzie a while ago, and he said that building a SaaS for churches is not a great idea if you want to make money. Really, you still can serve that audience if you love to, but you should be ready for downright donating your time and energy to that.
Yeah, absolutely. So and you're welcome to do that with your free
model.
Time,
that's
too.
To
but yeah, I mean, Patrick's right on the money here. And there's a lot of clients like that. And it's not that because churches are bad. It's because they have less to gain from working with you. So when we go back to the question of if you don't know who your ideal clients are, one way you can start figuring out is to start mapping out, first of all, mm-hmm. what are the different skills that you have? You can go pretty in depth into this, but that could be anything from Photoshop and HTML and some of these technical skills to other things that you have done that have been valuable. Like, for example, what have you learned in school? In my courses, I learned accounting, for example. Turns out that's a very useful skill when later analyzing business numbers. It could be things that you have done on the side, but start identifying what is that you really know. And then the hardest part of the exercise, but the most rewarding, is start thinking about how you can connect the skills that you have to hypothetical problems that you could solve for businesses. So, for example, again, I know how to build websites, and I know that websites can make businesses money. And I know that there's specific problems that those websites can solve. So for example, if it's an online store, we can help them get more sales. If it's a lead generation business, we can help them get more leads. There's types of web applications where the goal is to really save money by reducing the amount of human labor involved in completing tasks. There's lots of different problems out there. So you start mapping that out, and then this is a creative brainstorming exercise, but then you start mapping out, well, what kind of businesses out there are likely to have those problems? And you can create a pretty big list, especially if you're creative, and that's okay. But as you start going through that list, start asking yourself, well, what kind of businesses in this list are likely to pay me a lot of money to solve that problem? Because you might have, for example, your local mechanic. That's another business that probably isn't willing to pay a lot of money for a website because of the natures of that type of business. They usually don't promote themselves online a lot. Their margins are usually tight and so on. You might also see a home builder. I know for a fact home builders benefit a lot from having a great website, and especially a website that attracts home buyers because the margins on homes are very good. So you start looking through that list and you start thinking not just in terms of who has that problem, but who is likely to benefit a lot from you solving that problem. And here's a bit of more of a process that you can apply to it, but that's really it, is trying to identify who is it that is likely to have that problem and be likely to pay for it. And then, of course, you can do further filtering on. So, for example, we can talk about sphere of influence, but that's another big factor in deciding what type of business is likely to be a good client for you.
That is finding a niche where you already are an established authority or where you can become one.
Yeah. So depending on your situation, the first thing about your sphere of influence is simply who are you connected to? Who do you know? Who do you encounter on a daily basis? And the reality is all of us have different life experiences. All of us have different networks. But trust me, you definitely know people, and you're definitely somehow connected to the world in some way. So for a lot of people that are starting out and that are younger, the easiest, most obvious one is different types of small businesses, because there's a good chance that you know different business owners. So those businesses are in your sphere of influence because either you know them directly or you know someone that can connect you to them. That on its own doesn't mean that they're a great client. Again, there's great small business clients and not so great small business clients. And again, a lot of it comes back to what do they have to gain from working with you. But they're examples of companies in your sphere of influence. It might have something to do with what you've done in the past at your job. So if you've worked in telecom for 10 years, well, your sphere of influence within telecom is probably huge. Why? Because you know a lot of people there, which means that you can quickly get connected to a lot of companies, get connected to the right people, and you're no longer facing this uphill battle. Plus, you know the telecom industry pretty well. Of course, if you're in the rare percentage that has some sort of actual following, like you and me, where we have podcasts and you have books and things like that, then obviously you have a sphere of influence with that particular audience as well. But a lot of it isn't that you're an official authority and you speak and things like that. A lot of it is just you're somehow connected. You're somehow in the know, so that when you start trying to find these people and start trying to talk to them about their business, you're not quite starting from scratch. You have connections there for you. And that's a lot easier than waking up one day and saying, hey, I'm going to target aerospace, and you know nothing about airplanes, you know nobody that works in that industry, and you just decided that, hey, this is going to be a great client for you. That's going to be a harder way to do things.
Absolutely. This is a great way to put it. Thank you for expanding my thinking of that. But definitely not swimming against here.
Yeah, absolutely. You're going to find, if you talk to a lot of people that are freelancers or agency owners, you're going to find a lot of different stories and a lot of different strategies. And the reality is there's a lot of ways to get successful, but not all of them are of equal difficulty. You can really make life hard for yourself, or you can make life easy for yourself. And it's starting out strategically that's going to determine which path you end up on.
So once you defined who exactly you want to serve, the rule number one is probably to stick to that while you are interviewing new clients. So what would be the process for identifying whether those people who come in the door, the leads who cold email you or something like that, are your great client?
Ah, yes. So first of all, let's assume that you've done the work that we just talked about. And if you have, then you have probably a pretty good idea of what makes a good client for you. One of the big things that I look at is, again, profitability. Is this client going to be willing to spend enough money with me to solve their problem to make them worthwhile? Because one of the things I look at is this client going to be big enough that if I take on 3 to 10 of this type of client per year, then I can meet my financial goals? You don't really want to be working for 50 clients at a time. It's not sustainable. So you've hopefully figured all that out. Hopefully you have some other criteria you've identified about what makes a good client for you. For example, again, I personally don't like the idea of working for clients where they need quick turnaround times. You know, they send in a request on Monday and suddenly we have done a huge project for them by Wednesday. I don't like that. So I don't take on that type of work. So if you've actually gone to that trouble of identifying what you're looking for in a client, then your next step is you've got a client coming to you and you've got to figure out if this is a client that you want to take on. And there's several levels of screening that happen here.
Mm-hmm. Tell
first
us more.
Of all, when mm-hmm. they when they contact you, hopefully they're contacting you through some sort of email form. That doesn't always happen. Maybe they call you, maybe they email you directly, but hopefully they're contacting you through a form because that's your first chance to qualify them without spending a whole lot of time on them. So on my form, for example, it's very simple, but I ask the questions I care about. I get them to select a budget range, and that's really just me signaling to them that these are not $3,000 websites. You know, our minimum is about 15K right now, and our ideal clients spend at least 25 with us. So I do have a budget selection, but the most important things I ask is, what are you actually trying to accomplish with your website? And I give them opportunities to tell me more details about the project. And when I get this email, the nice thing is, because they filled out a form, I actually know a lot more about them versus somebody just emailing me and saying, hey, we want a website built. I can start looking that company up on LinkedIn and online and try to figure out what they do and how big of a business this is. Based on what information they've given me on the form, I can figure out if there's even a business case for them hiring us. And I tend to filter out a lot of leads at this stage, because this is where if I get someone contacting me where it's just painfully obvious that this is a small business or a small nonprofit or just somebody where if they spend $20,000 developing a website with us, they're not going to have enough of an impact from that website to make their money back. Well, I don't want to take their money. That would be dishonest of me. So I want to say no to them as quickly as possible and move on. I don't want to spend an hour with them on the phone only to let them down and tell them that, you know, this isn't going to work. So that's kind of your first check, is when that lead comes in, can you figure out enough about this company to start building a case in your head that they could meet your ideal client criteria? They could pay you enough. It seems like the type of project that you would want to do. It's in the area that you work in, whatever you choose to define. If that all checks out, that's when I want to get on the phone with them. And usually what I'll do is I'll reply via email and I'll either propose a couple times that we could do a call, or I'll send them a link to Calendly and have them book a time. And I want to get them on the phone so that I can have a real-time conversation with them. And a lot of people, this is where they get uncomfortable. They like doing everything over email. Let me tell you, you're going to lose a lot of business if you don't have that real-time conversation. Because first of all, other people are having a real-time conversation with that client. And second of all, you can just get so much better information if you're willing to talk to them. And when I get on that call, my first goal is not to figure out what they want in a website. At this point, it really doesn't matter. What I want to figure out is why they're really building this website. What are they actually trying to solve in their business? See, it always comes back to business problem. And I want to learn enough about their business to either convince myself that we can do something for them that is actually going to generate a return on investment, or this is just a project where we can't help this client. they are not going to benefit from working with us. So I try to make that analysis in my head as quickly as possible when I'm on the phone. So the longer I'm on the phone with them, the more likely they are to be the right client for me. That first 5 minutes is critical. I don't want to turn a 5-minute conversation into a 30-minute conversation if it's not the right fit. So that's where I'm figuring out what they're trying to solve, how much sales a year they do, or whatever critical factors affect whether I think our website can make them money. And if I don't think it's a right fit, I'll, you know, let them down gently and suggest someone else, and I'm done in 5 minutes. If we're talking on the phone longer, that's where there's a good chance I'm trying to build in my head now a case for why this is a good idea for them and how they are going to make money. So if they're going to spend $20,000 with us, but one way or another, they're going to make $100,000 back, well, that's an interesting project to me, because it's going to be very easy for me to pitch that project to them, and it's going to be very easy for them to say yes. And all of this, I'll say right now, all of this takes a lot of practice. And where a lot of freelancers struggle, especially initially, is this whole idea of thinking in business terms and even asking business questions like, how many sales a year, how much revenue a year do you get? AKA, how many sales a year do you get? A lot of people are not comfortable asking that. But if that's important for figuring out whether it makes sense for them to hire you, you got to ask that question. And you got to forget about the questions that don't matter right now. Nobody cares what color website needs to be built or what sort of design process they like or things like that. We're at the stage of trying to figure out if there's even a case for working together. The other technical details you can figure out later. And the more you practice, the more you go through this process, the better you'll get at it. And especially after you've worked with some clients and you've been able to really see the impact of your work, or maybe the lack of impact of your work, you'll be able to ask better questions. You'll be able to better assess what clients fit your criteria, and you'll get better at faster at this over time.
I have a question, because there is a ton of ways how such initial meeting with a client can go wrong, especially if you don't announce the purpose of the call immediately, that the purpose of that is just establishing whether you're a good fit. Because sometimes it kind of organically flows into figuring out the technical details, and then everyone is kind of lost because of unclarity. You still have not announced any kind of final decision, but you're already figuring out technical details and nobody knows the price. So do you usually say that, yes, we're taking this up, and yes, we're going to give you a quote later? Or how do you go? Or do you postpone all these decisions into follow-up emails?
First of all, a great point. Yes, it's very easy for these conversations to get derailed. And second of all, you have to figure out the process that you want to lead people through. So when I start a call, I do tell them, you know, I want to learn more about what they're trying to accomplish and see if there's a fit. That's an excellent point. But even if you start the call that way, some clients will naturally tend to keep shifting back into technical details. And that's not necessarily because they're a poor client. It's because they feel that that's what they're supposed to do. And if they've talked with 3 or 4 other web developers, those web developers have trained them that this is what they're supposed to do. Because unfortunately, most people waste that call. They really do. They ask the wrong questions. They dive into technical details, all these classical mistakes. So don't blame the client for that. And a simple way to get them back on track, I'll tell them something like, you know, yes, the color scheme's definitely important, and we do have a process for that. And, you know, we can get into as many questions as you like, but let's take a step back for a second and let's learn a little bit more about your business and what you're trying to accomplish with this website. Wording like that just seems to work really well, because I'm doing 2 things. One, I'm acknowledging that those things are important. I'm not dismissing them. People never like having their concerns and needs dismissed. So I acknowledge they're important, but then I also give us space to set those aside, that we'll come back to them, and then we can focus on the business conversation. And once we start having that business conversation, their eyes usually light up, and they usually realize, oh, wait a minute, this makes way more sense. And the reality is, for some of them, this is the first time someone's talked about their project in these terms. And so very quickly, they're actually eager to think about the business case. There's usually things that they haven't thought about. A really good sales call tends to end with them having realizations about their own business, because that's how they then see me as an expert and an authority. It's not because I can pick colors, which I can't, and that's why I have a designer. It's because I can help them see what's important in their business. And by the time we're done chatting, which could have been 30 minutes, could have been 60 minutes, depending on the call and situation, we're going to set next steps. And what those next steps are is going to really depend on your business and the complexity of the work that you sell. So I'm not going to give you a formula that fits everyone. For some people, the next step is the proposal. You've got everything you need from that one phone call to put together a proposal and send it to the client for approval and go through that whole process. If you're talking about a bigger project, you might have to have more meetings with them. Especially if you feel like the person that you're talking to is not the only decision maker. That's another common mistake. It's great to talk to whoever contacted you, but if you weren't able to connect with all of the decision makers on the project, then insist on a call where you connect with all of them, or don't write the proposal. Because time and time again, what happens is you can have a really great conversation with someone, and then what they're going to do is they're going to talk to their partners or to their boss. And those people haven't spoken to you. They haven't come around to your way of thinking. And those people have different priorities that you're not even aware of. And they're just going to see a piece of paper with a price on it, and they're going to say, oh, whatever. Go with the cheapest designer. And that's because you've skipped that process. So, you know, in that case, insist on a call. If you have really complicated work, you can charge for some sort of consultation where you actually figure out what sort of specification needs to be done on this project before you even quote the actual project. And that's totally fine too. And our mutual friend, Brennan Dunn, is a big fan of that approach. He calls it road mapping. It works really well, but it works really well, particularly on bigger projects. If you're selling stuff that's more in like the low thousands, do you really need a roadmap? Probably not. You can go straight to proposal. So it really depends on your process, the size of a project, and the complexity. But do make sure that you set clear next steps with the person on the phone. So back to your point, they're not left confused and wondering what's going to happen.
Right. This is a great, great process that you described. Thank you so much. What are the common red flags that don't necessarily relate to your ideal customer profile, but that you don't recommend you take up those clients never at all? Do you have those red flags, or are they specific to someone's business?
Oh, there's a ton of red flags, some general and some you're just going to have to learn for your own business. The first and easiest one is just a client that is definitely a poor fit. And that type of person, usually their focus immediately is price. They just want to know how much a website costs. And I get those calls all the time, and they're not willing to step back, talk about their business, what they really want to achieve. They just want some pricing. That's an instant red flag, because that just means that they're shopping for the lowest price. That's not always a bad thing. We've all been in positions where we don't have a lot of money to spend and we just need to get something done. But you generally don't want to be the one that is the low-cost provider. So they're probably a poor client for you. Another big red flag comes down to, once we start talking, we start realizing that what they think they want and what they need is just way too far apart, and they're not really willing to change their mind. And that does happen, and that's more subtle. They might be super focused on the idea that the solution to their problem is what they've described, and they don't even want to have a conversation about their business. They just want information on these specifications. And I'll usually say no to these as well, because if my opinion is that this is the wrong solution for you, I don't want any part of this. And a third red flag is timing. There's a certain type of client that is in constant emergency mode, and they'll use certain language to signify this, like, we need the proposal from you by tomorrow, and they'll give you some sort of good sounding reason, or we need this project done in 8 weeks because of some other good sounding reason. And they're just constantly putting this timeline pressure on you, and everything sounds like an emergency. That's the type of client where you're going to experience two things. One, your entire working relationship with them is going to be an emergency, even 5 years into it. They're always going to be springing stuff on you on last minute. They're always going to be giving you good excuses on why something has to be done tomorrow. And weirdly enough, this is the same type of client that's going to drag their feet when you ask them for something. And, you know, if you're listening to this and you haven't encountered this yet, you might not believe me. But trust me, that is what's going to happen. You're going to be constantly against the wall to get something done to them yesterday against your normal timelines. And then when you need something for them, it's going to take forever to get it. And the two usually go hand in hand. And that, for me, huge red flag.
That is such a red flag indeed. And because mutual work is always an exchange process, work, feedback, materials, work, materials, work, feedback, et cetera, et cetera. It's a cycle.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't want to be involved with someone who's putting so much stress on you. And generally speaking, avoiding strict timelines, I just love the way you put it because I have a similar philosophy with my clients. It takes so much stress off your daily life because you're taking away the necessity to ship it tomorrow strict, and you can avoid, such stress in daily life.
Yeah, absolutely. And on that note, one of the best things I ever did for myself was to get the client involved in timelines. So now when I put together a timeline, it's not just about deliverables coming from Tilted Pixel, it's deliverables coming from the client as well. And I work with them to figure out how much time they need for those deliverables. And I track all of these dates in a spreadsheet, and hopefully soon in a different piece of software because spreadsheets are a pain, but I track when the deliverables actually came in. And so if a client is now late with their work, that's great. They're going to see it on the timeline and they're going to be able to see the impact that them being late has on the final completion of the project. Because oftentimes clients, even great clients, they don't realize that when they take 2 weeks to respond to something instead of 2 days, that actually messes everything up. For lots of reasons, but actually allowing them to see it and have some degree of control over it to see that there's a cause and effect of their actions is wonderful. And then you're not the bad guy because the spreadsheet says that that's the new timeline. That's not you telling them that. That's just math. And then math can beat a bad guy. and weirdly enough, it works.
One of my last questions for today would be, in addition to objective red flags and criteria and everything, do you trust your gut feeling when all the criteria are met, but there is still something off with the client? Maybe the communication, maybe something else.
Always trust your gut feeling. I can't think of a single scenario where I've gone against my gut and the client ended up being wonderful. And I can definitely think of scenarios where I ignored my gut and things were not so wonderful. And it's everything that you've explained. There's just something about the personality fit or just something about the type of work you're being asked to do where it's not really quite what you do and it sounds like you could do it. But, you know, it's not your ideal type of work. Usually those projects end in disaster because everything takes 3 or 4 times longer. And then the client's disappointed, you're disappointed, and so on. So if your gut is telling you something, definitely listen to it.
I think the verbalized version of it is that a little mismatch in personalities usually comes with huge discrepancy in expectations from you on their side, and that leads to a disastrous result.
Oh, absolutely, as well. And on that note, always make sure you're setting those expectations upfront as well. So that goes back to ideas like timelines and when they deliver things to you and what responsibilities are theirs versus what responsibilities are yours. Because you can have a gut feeling that maybe your expectations are out of line, but you actually want something in print and you want both of you to agree to this. And that way, you know, you can actually have some transparency. And if that isn't the right fit for them, that's great. They can move on to someone else. But you're not guessing at what their expectations are because you've both agreed to it on paper.
I'm sure you have a ton of episodes on your podcast that are relevant to our today's topic. Maybe you could call out a couple and we can link to them in the show notes so that people can continue exploring this, qualifying clients and making sure they're a good fit.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, first of all, with the Freelance Transformation Podcast, what I'm really trying to accomplish is to dive deep into what makes a freelance business work. So we do get into the weeds. We do try to figure out what actually is going to work for people. And the way we do it is I bring on guests every single week that have done something very well in their business. So if we're going to talk about qualifying, you're putting me on the spot a little bit because we have over 150 episodes, but off the top of my head, some of the recent ones that I think we've talked about on this topic would be Mike Julian, Paul Jarvis. Those are definitely good ones. And and the first episode that I did with Kurt Elster, I've had him on the show twice. He talked a lot about his journey of figuring out who the right clients are for him. It's one of the earliest episodes. Kurt Elster, that is a great one to check out as well. And of course, you know, you can subscribe to the podcast and learn, you know, something new about the business of freelancing and how to make it work every single week.
Wonderful. So my usual question is, where can people find you and your work online? Obviously, the podcast is one of your biggest things. Maybe anything else I'm missing out?
Yeah, absolutely. So I do email my list semi-regularly. So if you email or if you go to freelancetransformation.com, you'll see a nice big box to put your email address in. What that's going to do is that's going to let me send you essays, thoughts, and other things I have about freelancing every 1 to 2 weeks, depending on my writing schedule. And that's a good way to continue finding out what's going on. And then, of course, there's your podcast player. If you just search for Freelance Transformation on whatever software you're listening to this in right now, it should come up. You can hit subscribe. And that way you'll be getting a new episode every single week.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much, Matt, for sharing your wisdom today. I'm sure we could do like another 5 hours of talking how exactly to do the client process, but I hope that today's content will give people a great, at least, you know, from the top of their head.
Thank you. And yeah, absolutely. We could keep talking more, but it's been a great opportunity. And thanks for having me on your show.
Thank you, Matt, and have a great day.
If you enjoyed listening to this episode, please leave a review on iTunes. It will help other people discover this podcast.